Matthias, let's just take a second to talk about our Patreon channel. Obviously, a lot of people love the show, and we get a lot of messages from people asking us how to support us and help us grow the podcast. Now, Patreon is obviously, without doubt, the best way to do it. It really helps us grow the show, helps us pay people who help us out, helps us, you know, keep shining the job, the editor behind the scenes. Why do you want to just let people know what they get, some of the perks?
Yeah, I mean, we offer so many interesting extra things for patrons. I mean, we have a bonus episode, we do Q&As, and we're also looking into other ways of like getting our Patreon supporters special access to some of my very deep, fantastic knowledge and such things.
Yeah, you're wanting to introduce some, not one-on-one, but small group lectures on specific subjects, which I think would be amazing. Patrons would absolutely love that. I would absolutely love that. You know, half an hour topic of you just ranting without me interrupting on a subject has to be perfect. You know, who's not going to love that?
Yeah, like things, you know, we talk about on the podcast, maybe like we mentioned something about Viking ships or something that has to do with the mythology, and people want to know more about that. And then we can like dig deep into that for like 30 minutes in a short lecture. I think a lot of people would find that very interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, let's not forget, anybody who signs up to the Patreon at any level is going to get a bonus episode every week. It's either going to be the story time episode that we do with Jonas Lorentzen, which you have to agree with, Hayes, is one of the funniest times you must have all week. It is brilliant. He does
such amazing.
A good job.
I love it.
It is. And then the other episode, we're still undecided 100% on what it's going to be, but it looks like it's going to be a conversational type episode where me and Matthias just get a little bit more personal about ourselves, but also we're going to let people have the chance to ask questions, Q&A, whether it's about the podcast or about us. You're going to be able to put your question to us through Patreon. And then we're going to have a little bonus episode where we explore those and people get a little bit more interactive with those, which I think would be fun for the fans.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I feel like I'm seeing with our audience is that they really like to be interactive with us. So we're trying to offer as many opportunities on our platform to do that outside of social media. Otherwise, because that can get a little much sometimes.
Yeah, there we go. I mean, honestly, if you just jump over to Patreon.com/ Nordic Mythology Podcast, you can have a look at all the different tiers we've got there. They start from $5 up to $20, and you can cancel at any point. You can try it out for a month, listen to the old episodes, listen to the old storytime episodes, cancel it if you don't enjoy it, and there we go. But we're more than sure confident that you'll like what you hear. Matthias, do you know what episode today is?
It's the 100th episode. We have been at it for 100 episodes at this point.
I mean, 100 official episodes, because I did lose the first recording we did with Katie Ran.
That is right.
Had to redo that one. And then I think we've had a couple that the quality was a little sketchy on that we've dropped. And also we do the bonus episodes on Patreon, but it's 100 official episodes.
It is the 100th official episode. I wish I had like one of those kazoo thingies that goes meh, we could have balloons falling down or something like that too.
I was going to try to get a hat and everything, but I forgot and didn't. But
New Year's is over.
That's it. Yeah, I think we should start by just saying thank you to everybody who obviously has listened and continues to listen. The show wouldn't be here without people actually downloading it and listening to me and you ramble week after week. It's amazing that so many people do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love to like thank everybody for following us and being part of this interesting journey.
Yeah, it's definitely been interesting. And like I said, I have so much respect for us doing the podcast, because it's ultimately changed. I guess it has kind of changed my life in a way, because I was very much on the edge of being a Viking bro, I feel. I didn't know any better. And then we met, we've done the podcast, and I've come over to the light side, I guess.
Well, this is actually the dark side. If anybody's wondering, this is the dark side. But what does it even mean to be a Viking bro? It means that, you know, you think Viking stuff is cool and you like the artwork and, you know, and when we're talking about specifically about the bro crowd, right, it also means you like lift heavy things or do martial arts or something like that too. I think there's a lot of people
that actually could be me then.
Exactly. And me too. So I don't think it's that bad.
I mean more kind of along the side of people who get a lot of their information from memes and just quick Wikipedia searches. And unfortunately, I mean, I don't think there's a necessary, obviously it's not good, but people are just so busy they don't know where else to get it from. So that's where I was getting it from. And I just assumed at that point that what I was reading was accurate and that it just wasn't as complicated as it is.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I think that's how most people approach most things. You know, we think that they're less complicated than they actually are. And I think it's really important that, you know, there are places like this podcast that make sure to remind people it is actually complicated. And we should consider why we say and do and think certain things about the Viking Age and all of that stuff. So that's our mission.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And to us, just as well as everybody who listens to the podcast and also supports Horns of Odin, you know, I get a bunch of people who come in and buy from us or check out our stuff because of this podcast. They listen to the show and then find out about it. So in that respect, it's obviously had a big positive on me. So yeah, I just have to thank you to everyone who even just sends us a message, takes the time to write a review. It's all positive. It all helps us keep going. And obviously the patrons get an extra special shout out because they help us keep Shan in a job and help us keep growing the show. But yeah, just a big thank you all around. I think it is needed.
Absolutely. And applause.
And applause. Shan, insert applause here now. And now after that brilliant applause. all right. Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farron, co-owner of the company Horns of Odin, and I'm joined, as always, by Dr. Matthias Nordvik.
Hello, everybody. I think that was my original intro. Hello, everybody.
Howdy. Like, who is it off the Simpsons that does that? There's one of them.
Isn't it Krusty the Clown? Or
is Dr. Nick.
Just... Oh, yeah. It's Dr. Nick.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, everybody.
Well, we were so bad in the early days.
I started switching it up because Jonas was making fun of me. So I figured he said I sounded a little too much like Lars Ulrich. I've switched it up over time, but now I'm back to the OG.
Stick with it.
And this time we are joined by Luciani Pezzoli, who runs Children of Ash, that you can find on Instagram, which will give you fascinating, interesting details about Viking Age art. I don't think that there are many people out there who have more knowledge and more comprehensive understanding of developments of Viking art than Luciano. And aside from that, Luciano is also a tattoo artist in Copenhagen in Denmark. So welcome to the show, Luciano.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, your third appearance.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's amazing.
No, so to put a little outline, I guess, into the show, the six main art styles, we've done three of them in the past. So if people listening want to jump back and listen to that one, you're going to get the first three chronologically. And then we're going to look at the latter three in this episode. I think, am I right, Luciana?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, we're going to look into the Christian side of Viking art. Well, it's actually the parts that we that most people like, because it's the part that is recognizable.
Mm-hmm. No, I think these are my three favorite styles of Viking Age art.
Why aren't they your favorite?
Because they're pretty.
Because they're pretty. Okay.
I think that, yeah, I think they, but like you said, I think you're right in that they're recognizable as what they are. Certainly, I think Mammon would be my favorite because it looks like almost like what it is. You can pick out the beast and it has a nice shape to it. So yeah, I think that's Mammon would be my favorite.
Yeah, it's an interesting dance between Scandinavia, pagan Scandinavia, and the introduction of Christianity, which came first as a sort of on an aesthetic level with the representation of imagery and beasts that are recognizable and ideas of symmetry and such, even before it started getting introduced as a spiritual concept, let's say. Or so that's the interesting part, because Scandinavia didn't get basically colonized by Christianity, but it also had its own say, and it refused also certain parts of Christian art until very last style, let's say. So it's quite interesting in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
Something that, for example, in Celtic, in the Celtic side of art in the British Isles didn't happen in such an interesting way, because it was much more Christian to begin with. So there was no interaction, no dance. It was decided from the beginning, basically. Mm-hmm. So that's basically the idea. The first style that we're going to talk about is Mammon style, and it's usually connected. I mean, according to the latest studies, it's connected to Harald Bluetooth. It's quite interesting. The first three styles were more spread out throughout Scandinavia. We're not going to talk about them again, but after Borre style, the next two styles, so there is Jelling and Mammon, where we believe from what we know that is that they were a sort of sort of branding styles. So they were strictly connected with the Danish kingdom, the Rising Kingdom, and they were also kept very strictly to southern Scandinavia. It was not like everyone in Scandinavia did or was allowed to do Jelling and Mammon style.
So it was sort of like an exclusive elite style?
Yeah, well, it was connected and branded. It was used to give a sort of aesthetic face to the kingdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is really interesting, because I mean, what we know of Harald Bluetooth as a king in Denmark, of course, he's a Christianizing king. At least he claims to have Christianized all of Denmark, and he's also, compared to his predecessors and also a lot of those who come after him, he is a very organized king, right? He does a lot to organize the country. He has like a very clear vision. We can see this in pretty much everything he does. So it makes perfect sense that, his art form, that it makes perfect sense actually that he would invent his own art, really.
Yeah.
Like the, like it almost like, you know, a Medici or something like that, like a Renaissance magnate in one of the northern Italian towns, right?
How important would that be, just to invent your own art style? Is that kind of an ego thing, I guess, by the king, to be like, this is my art, everyone look at it, look how amazing it is?
Well, it also allows you to this type of art, the branding of art also allows you to give a branding to your alliances and to your subjects. So through gifts and certain kind of medallions and recognizable objects, you actually can, that's why we think that they kept it so so strictly branded, so that it was not, you know, that it actually gave a sort of impetus, a sort of a punch to the political development of the kingdom.
Mm-hmm. So would they make it quite complicated on purpose, so then people wouldn't be able to copy it?
That's a good question. I think that it was already developing in a rather complicated manner. I'm not sure if that is the case. It's a bit complicated. I mean, it's like, yeah, they got the best ones. You know, the king would actually, you know, gather the best type of artists. But I've put together a couple of examples, and especially there are two caskets. Actually, I'm going to talk only about those for this style, which are believed to have been gifts to important key players in the Christian mainland powers. The first casket is the Bamberg casket. It actually, I'll show you.
So before we necessarily look straight at the casket, what are the defining features of Mammoth style? Obviously, maybe you can use the casket to point them out. Because I imagine each style has their own kind of features of what makes this artwork Mammon. And for anybody listening who can't see the videos will go on to YouTube, but also we'll leave any of the caskets or whatever we brought up, we'll tag them in the description so you can find them.
One second. All right. So this would be the Bamberg casket. And this one actually exists.
Wow.
Is the only one of two that actually exists. It's made of, presumably, it doesn't say, it's presumably made of walrus tusk. Mm-hmm. On the label there, actually, which is, it's in Munich, in Germany, it says that it might be mammoth tusk, but I'm not sure. I don't think so.
So anybody listening, how do you spell the name? Because this thing is absolutely stunning. Anybody who thinks that I guess people in the Vikings were savages and uncultured, you need to take a quick look at this, because it is beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. I don't think there's many people on earth today that could make anything near the quality of what this is. It's a stunning piece of artwork, and it's extremely, extremely detailed and delicate. I imagine it's quite breathtaking when you see it in person.
Absolutely. And it's the collection of the work of three different workshops.
Mm-hmm.
The carved walrus tusk in the white areas, you know, the engraved or the carved ones, and then the engraved gilded bronze bands around the corners and there's a lining around. those are engraved in bronze and then gilded. And then at the top, there are these beast heads. They're like four raven heads and four wolf heads. So we're talking about three different groups of craftsmen.
Okay, so it's not just not one person would make the entire piece.
Absolutely not. No way. No. You can actually see it from the differences in within the style.
Mm-hmm. What we're realizing here is that like the assembly line for manufacturing was already invented back in the Viking Age.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it didn't happen very often. It was, you know, that's the fact that they did that. It actually underlines the importance of making something like this. What you said, Daniel, is actually extremely accurate. Whoever thought they were barbarians, well, this is designed to show exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm. I mean, here you can see obviously where it's been damaged on the top there over time. So you can see how thin and delicate and brittle this thing is. And they've managed to put it's the level of detail. Like I say, I urge anyone who's listening to this to kind of Google and just pull this up and you can look at it whilst you listen or pause the episode and go and look at it, because this has now just become on my bucket list of things I have to see in person.
Absolutely.
Because it's like I say, it's breathtakingly beautiful. It is an absolute piece of art.
What is the level of reconstruction on it? Has it lasted since middle of the 900s, late 900s?
This is from the late 900s. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it hasn't been like reassembled or anything like that.
It has been changed in a little bit, for what regards the key.
Okay.
You can see at the top, under the two wolf heads, there is this reversed T hole.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the original key hole.
Okay, so it was locked as well.
That's a modern keyhole. So that's the renovation to it.
So do they have the key?
I don't think so.
Oh, see.
So they don't know what's inside it.
I think it's empty, but it's not that it hasn't been found somewhere. It's always been it at Bamberg. It was a gift to presumably the daughter or the wife of the emperor, the German emperor.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a reliquary, most probably. So both chests were. But the interesting thing, I want to go a little faster if I can, because there is a lot of things to, and that are quite interesting as well.
Okay, absolutely.
There is a number of beasts in a certain order, and that as it's a bit of a Dan Brown kind of situation. We know there is a meaning to all this, but we don't know exactly what it is. Okay, here is the reconstruction of the whole thing.
Have you done that?
Yeah, I did it. Yes, I reconstructed the whole thing.
Fuck, that's so impressive.
All right, let's. There is a different hypothesis about the meaning of all these beasts. So on the lid, you can see there is here upside down a lion, and on the left there's two eagles. At the bottom, what seems like two dragon-like creatures, quadruped-like dragons, and a mask on the right side. Mammon style is, to talk about a few of the particularities, is the style where masks go completely insane. They, you see them on stones, you see them like in large size. which is something that goes a bit, you know, it's Christianity just likes it and doesn't like it. But I had a discussion with some mask historians, and they were saying that the relationship of Christianity with masks was a bit ambiguous, because they didn't like masks when they were actually used. But when they were integrated in a cultural heritage coming from Greece and Rome, etc., that was not so bad. So they did have that in their art. So that's probably the reason why they didn't cringe too much when they saw that coming from Vikings.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask what the main characteristics of the Mammon style were. I got distracted by the beauty of the casket when you brought it up before.
Yeah. There's a number of characteristics. Because we're talking about a stream of art development, so it's really hard. I mean, it's like they would not really understand what you're talking about when you talk about Mammon. They would have collected a number of, you know, high quality workshops and let them work for them. So like Gorm the Old with Yelling style and Arnold Bluetooth with Mammon style, but it was part of a development. So it's very difficult to say, like, okay, this is square, you know, this is probably some of the best of art at the moment. One very interesting characteristic is that foliage appears in Viking art, and this casket in particular is where it gets quite interesting, because it actually combines. You can actually see the dance between Christianity or the Christian Greek Roman tradition and the Scandinavian tradition blend together, because at first they are separate. So you see, if you see on the four sides of the casket, you can see this repeating bands of acanthus, which, you know, like it's like the Corinthian capital in Greek art, etc. It was, you know, very big in Romanic art, so it started seeping through into Scandinavia. But it's quite interesting, because at the corners there is the Scandinavian interpretation of the same foliage idea, which is much more edgy and bulbous and on sides, you know, with all the knots that connect it. For example, here at the bottom side of the casket, where you see the smaller mask, right? Can you see it? Right. Yes. On the two sides at the top, between the lid and the side, there are these four small registers in which the Scandinavian foliage and the acanthus are blended. And it's the first time we know of that they did.
Mm-hmm.
So you see the lobes of acanthus and the structures and the knots of the Scandinavian trees, let's say, on the sides.
Mm-hmm. And they're blending into a mask figure, really, which is really interesting too.
Right. Well, what I wanted to say on a symbolic sense, it's like I read a thesis on this casket, and I don't remember the name of the scholar. Just, oh my God, that's horrible. But he hypothesizes that the beasts on the lid should symbolize the gospel writers, what would
connect these images to the authors of the gospels.
Well, because the authors of the Gospels have also St. John's and Mark, Matthew and Luke have mm-hmm. their symbols. And they are the eagle, the lion, the angel, and the ox. So we've got two eagles, mm-hmm. which is rather strange, because when you see the symbol of the evangelists, you see them as one, mm-hmm. Not as some one and some two. Mm-hmm. So you got one lion at the top, a mask, which should be the angel, and at the bottom is the most... Yeah,
I'm not sure I can follow that guy's interpretation.
No, I think he was a bit pushing it like rather strongly.
Mm-hmm. Is it just me, or do those wolf heads on the very top, do they look very similar to the head that we find on that so-called Icelandic wolf cross?
Yeah, they could be, yes. Because actually the interesting thing about those wolf heads is that they are actually technically yelling star. Mm-hmm. So they are also the raven heads at the corners. So the 3D guys were actually a bit old fashioned, if you know. What we do know about this, you know, this Dan Brown kind of mystery, which is also quite interesting, even if sometimes it's even more interesting than what we actually do know. There is a correspondence between the animals at on the lid and the ones on the sides, but they are turned 90 degrees to the lid is turned 90 degrees anti-clockwise. So on the lid, if you follow me, here's the lion, and at the center of the side of the right side you see the lion. Then if you go to the eagles on the left, here you see the an eagle here at the top. And then on the mask side, actually, you see all the other three animals. So you don't see the mask at the bottom place, let's say, but you see bird, lion, and dragon. So The other three animals on the lid. Mm-hmm. But the quite interesting part is that there is also a correspondence of animals as is, so with the next casket. So if you try to remember, at the top of the lid you've got the lion, mm-hmm. and then on the same side you'll have the bird in center, and then there's these two strange beasts that looked like sort of lion-esque kind of creatures with a human mask. And they're going towards the bird.
Mm-hmm. And you have to assume that in something that delicate and detailed, things are put in a certain place for a reason. That it's not
absolutely, absolutely.
Not putting it there.
Oh, definitely. Actually, I have a picture that shows that side of both caskets. Here you go. So this is at the bottom you see the lion and the two sphinx-like creatures, mm-hmm. and the bird in the middle, right? And on the other casket at the top, you see a lion at the top, two birds in the middle, and then again, those two strange sphinx-like male creatures. But this time they're going outwards. And they don't appear in any other part, those creatures. There are two, and they're in that position. And that's it.
So what does it mean?
Do you have no idea?
What does it mean?
Well, I was wondering if you had a hypothesis. Maybe you had an idea. Well, maybe you thought
actually No.
This is one of the incredibly fascinating things about Viking Age art, and especially right at that time where Christianity really hits. It is so incredibly difficult to actually figure out what the hell did they mean with this stuff. Like, because a famous example of attempts to interpret, for instance, a beast is the yelling stone that Harold Bluetooth raised, where he said that he Christianized the Danes and, you know, conquered Norway and all that funky stuff. And like, there's a beast on the side of it of some kind. And people have been like, yeah, that's probably like, a dragon, or maybe it's a lion, or maybe it's a devil. And, you know, there's like a million interpretations of it, really.
Absolutely. I mean, it's like, but there is intention here. I mean, it's like the bottom casket, like the one we just saw. Yeah. So the lid is turned 90 degrees counterclockwise, but it's not by mistake.
No,
it's actually it's done on purpose. So it's not that, you know, like the lid fell off in the wrong way and they just put it back, because there is, you know, the other four beasts actually correspond to the second casket as they are. So there is a twist and there is a correspondence. So they are in the right place. So there is a meaning to the twist and a meaning to that's the big problem with, you know, like you talk about me knowing all there needs to be known about art. Yes, but the great frustrating bit is that I can touch the symbols, but I can, I can't. Well, for the majority, I can't tell what exactly they're standing on for.
Right. Know? Mm-hmm. That, no, I mean, and yeah, that's what makes this so fascinating too. And I'm looking at this casket and trying to consider the intentionality behind it. And the lid has four images, and only three of these images are reproduced in the side images. And I'm wondering to myself, why not all four? Like, what is it that, what kind of decision happened there? What is the purpose?
Could there be significance to the mask? Because all the other three face as if you were looking at the casket are facing you, whereas the mask is facing in towards the lid. It's almost facing away from you rather than towards you.
Yeah, there's some very deep symbolic meaning to this. Yes.
There is also one thing that maybe it could be interesting just to introduce as an idea to the public, is that when you see masks in Viking art, especially at this stage, they are very, very different from images of god faces, because they have all the tendrils going out as if you'd have all a headdress around it. When you see, let's say, a Loki's face on Fornus stone or on other stones, you see a face. It's a mm-hmm. face. It's not a mask. Because a mask has actually a different meaning. It actually stands for a gateway between dimensions. And that is what it might be here. I mean, and I don't say it lightly, especially because if you look at the second casket, now we can move to the next casket.
So if I could just like stop for a second and then throw an idea in here. So what an image of a mask like that we see on the Bamberg casket might represent, it could be something like a syncretic Scandinavian idea of what God is in and of itself, like their attempt to work through the depiction and not depiction of divinity or something like that. I hope that silence is not because Luciano thinks I'm totally crazy.
No. I mean, I find it a bit, it's very difficult with Christianity, because Christianity just like kind of tolerates masks. So the depiction of actually a mask connected to the God, it's, you know, would strike me as pretty surprising, you see now the shape of this casket is the shape of a longhouse.
Mm-hmm.
It's not by chance. It actually is the shape of a longhouse. And if you look at the two extremes on the left and the right side, there's masks there, mm-hmm. only there. So that's where the doors would be.
Mm-hmm.
So they are the gates, and they are also, if you look at the picture of the casket, they are the most guarded parts of the place. You know, that's where the fiercest beasts are collected. Yep. There's a sort of griffin-like head right in the center on the side, like an eagle's head with ears. And then two wolves, like really looming over the door. They're really guarding that entrance.
They stick out from the casket. So you said this one is the Camin casket.
Yes.
I mean, the shape of it alone is obviously a lot more intricate. The other one is, I mean, it's not simple by any stretch of the imagination, but it's a square shape. Whereas this is, like I say, it's almost, for me, from my past, it's a rugby ball shape. That's what it looks like to me. But obviously it has all the different, it's not got perfectly square panels. The panels are all very kind of got different, they're all different shapes, they're all unique. So they kind of been easy to place and carve.
Well, one of the characteristics of this style is that the endings of the tendrils of the knotwork, let's say, are very organic, very loose. In the previous style, in Yelling style, everything, all the bits and pieces just matched with exact the right space around them. But this style is much looser in the ending. It's much more organic. It looks, you know, if you look at the designs here, it's, you know, if you look at the lot, it looks like sort of living worms moving around, right, from a distance, right? They're like, it's a very alive kind of,
I was gonna say animals matter. In the thicket, you know, animals, you know, in the woods, and mm-hmm. like that's how I'm seeing this.
Yeah,
it's really, really fascinating.
It's very organic. It's very, you know, it moves. It fills the space. Also, you ask for characteristics, like if you consider the Celtic kind of knotwork. Celtic knotwork is always equal to itself. It doesn't, you know, like it has to be perfectly rounded in the hoops, etc. And this knotwork adapts to the space it fills. It's very often like I compare it to the way intestines look. They basically shape as they touch each other, you know. So there's mm-hmm. It basically fills the space, so as the space it has. Yeah,
it's just so complex. It blows my mind every time I look at these.
Yeah, right.
But also they don't waste any space. You know, they've got whatever the shape is of the panel, it's full. It goes to the edge. It goes to all four, five, whatever, however many edges. And it's obviously designed to fit that particular shape.
Absolutely. But that's one thing, given like if somebody was interested in actually, you know, embarking in designing their own Mammon style things, the most or any kind of Viking art, especially of Mammen, until Mammen and Ringerike. And Uranus is a little bit different, but the frame is the first thing you've got, because the design and everything in it actually talks to the signs. So you need a frame before you have a design. A big mistake a lot of people make is they make a design floating in the air. And that is really against how they would work. They would actually work with the boulder.
Okay, yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, whenever I've ever tried to draw, I guess I just start in the middle of an A4 piece of paper, and I'm sure so many other people do, or even, you know, if you're drawing on the iPad, you start with a blank page and just expect something to happen. But like you say, it makes sense that you can see clearly that these images have been made to fit each piece perfectly.
Exactly. Right. Shall we run ahead and move to the next part?
I think we should just leave this episode on the caskets on Mammon.
All right,
yeah, and then sure. we because we've got a bonus episode to record again after this. But I think I don't want to rush through the other ones, because I know that they're going to be as equally fascinating. So we can do those two separately, in their own kind of, in their own episodes, and really spend time on it, because you're going to love this. And I think what we should do as well is we're going to instead of releasing the YouTube episode like 30 days after, let's just, when this episode goes live, we'll put the video episode live at the same time, so people can jump on there and see the visuals of this, because they really do want to be enjoyed by the visuals that you're bringing up, because they are beautiful, and it really helps you kind of understand a lot more.
Yeah, sure.
I don't think we should rush through them. This is so fascinating, and I want to make sure we get the most out of this, because I know that anything that I find incredibly fascinating, I'm sure that the people listening are going to as well.
I hope I didn't bore you too much. Absolutely.
Definitely not boring anybody. Not. I think anybody who is looking at me on the screen will be seeing my nose, mostly because I'm like sitting and trying to look so closely at it.
It's never boring. It is the edge of the sea kind of stuff for me anyway. I just think it's beautiful, and like you say, there's just so much meaning to it that we don't know.
Can I give you a spoiler for the next? Or
yeah, absolutely.
This the Yelling Stone. Is quite interesting for many reasons, but one thing I've noticed is that it has a structure that is like no other stone I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at what it looked like, and what it actually does look like is not a stone, but a piece of very specific jewelry. Mm-hmm. This kind of braids on the side with knots at the corners is a signature type of design for Gotlandic jewelry.
Huh.
So okay. what I think is, and, you know, like, it's my feeling, and from what I know of their signature style, is that Harald Bluetooth might have hired not a stone carver, but a jeweler to design the structure.
Interesting. Okay. Very interesting.
Because it really doesn't look like any other stone. And it, if you look at the Gotlandic box brooches and you know, like all these very specific brooches that they have, they always have this kind of structure with these mm-hmm. knots at the corners and this ongoing chain pattern on the ridges.
This is so interesting, because on the other side where he has the main part of the text, it looks like an illuminated manuscript. And it seems like there's again, I think we should assume, you know, the highest level of intentions in design, right? So we have to ask ourselves, like, what does it mean for him to bring a Gotlandic jeweler into designing the side? What does it mean for him to have designed the other side as an illuminated manuscript and so on? Like, I think it's do you think that he's basically trying to signal this is where continental and Scandinavian culture come together, or what are we dealing with here?
I think Gotland is a very interesting hub. They were at the top of Viking art. Some time ago, I listened to one of your episodes where you were discussing slavery. Mm-hmm. And how it would work, and Daniel, you were asking a lot of questions about it, and well, Gotland is very particular in that sense, and I have a hypothesis about Gotland, because Gotland was at the top of this Viking design even before Viking, like even Vendel design, for a straight 300 years.
Mm-hmm.
They were like,
if I remember correctly, is this really where like Viking art is invented?
Pretty much, yes. And yeah, even if something was invented somewhere else, they basically improved it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where it was simplified, they went more elaborate. Mm-hmm. It was always the top, and it got me really suspicious, because I thought, how do you keep that level of quality 300 years straight? Is nearly impossible if you think about the ratio of population and the specialized skills. I mean, like every time I go to a Viking exhibition, like the last one at the National Museum, I just get completely shocked about the minute size of all these designs. Mm-hmm. So you need to have a specific kind of vision to be able to do that kind of work. Not only nimble fingers, but you really need a sort of distorted vision to begin with. Mm-hmm. You cannot do that with your naked eye and keep it up for any amounts of time.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at candidates that are a very specific, very, very specific people.
Aliens.
Well, it's a small percentage of the population. So imagine you have, say, 200,000-300,000 people around Scandinavia, let's say. How many amongst them will be, have that skill on and on for 300 years? It's not really easy, I mean, to find, such kids to bring up.
Is it possible this is almost kind of bred into people, that they were raised from a young age, that this was going to be their kind of path?
It could be, but it doesn't make sense that in other parts of Scandinavia it didn't happen. They were not so regularly at high standards. They had their good periods, but they were not always at very high standards like Gotland. And Gotland is pretty well known for having made its wealth and kept its wealth through slavery. So slave trading.
Well, I mean, so if we look at it historically, Gotland is also... it is the hub, right, in the Baltic Sea for all Viking activity. This is where you would go through, going in any direction with your ships. Mm-hmm. And it makes perfect sense then, if you have an industry that is based off of having slaves that are basically trained to make this kind of jewelry.
You can pick and choose pretty much. You know, you'd get an amount of human resources at a regular pace that you can actually select and keep.
Yeah. And it's, you know, there's even a mythological link here, the story about Verlund, who is a master smith, sort of like a semi-god figure of some kind. The story has its origins possibly in the Netherlands, and then very early on in the Viking Age in the 700s, it comes into Scandinavia and becomes part of Scandinavian mythology. And this story is also about a guy who is captured, and because he's a good goldsmith and he's good at making jewelry, and then he is his tendons in his knees or something like that are cut, so he can't mm-hmm. run away. And it's an evil Swedish king who does it, as far as I remember. And there's also something about an island, but I can't remember that part. And I'm like, you know, desperately looking for my book for reference here on my desk. But yeah, please go on. It's just really fascinating.
So yeah, I mean, possibly, you know, Gotland may be, you know, the reason that art developed off of foreign human resources. So another blow to the white supremacists.
Well, I mean, as far as I know, that the big study on genetics in the Viking Age that came out a year or two ago, you know, Gotland is one of the primary places that they have used the sources from, bones, I presume, and yeah, they found that the populations in places like Gotland, the Danish archipelago, and other island communities in Scandinavia are the primary areas mixing between Scandinavians and populations from other places in Europe, and this mixing seems to be happening distinctly in the Viking Age, at least based off of what they're writing in that study.
Yeah, it makes sense, but you know, the result of all this is that Gotland was the hub to be reckoned with. So if Harald Bluetooth wanted to construct something extraordinary, he would call somebody from Gotland. If the ladies from Osaberka in the late 700s or early 800s wanted something special, they got people from Gotland. Mm-hmm. It was a constant. So wherever you see a conglomerate of high quality art, there is always Gotlandic art in it.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
So just to add the source to what I was saying before, in the poem of Verlund, it says about what the king does to Verlund is that the sinews were cut through at the back of his knees, and he was put on an island near the land called Sævastad. There, he made all kinds of treasures for the king. No man dared to go to him except the king alone. So, I mean, that might be sort of like the mythological component to this.
Yeah. Exactly. That could very well be a definite connection. Yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
This is so fascinating.
I think we should pause here, because there is something I want to finish on that might take like 10 minutes anyway. So yeah, Luciano, if you're happy for us to put a pin in this and then come back next time and look at Ringerike.
It's a never-ending story.
Oh, it is. It is. It's absolutely fascinating. It really is. I love the artwork. I'm obsessed with that. I just wish I had more time to practice it.
We'll make a horn together.
We will. Yeah, absolutely. We, without a doubt. But hopefully, if you can unshare your screen, because Sophie made some lovely artwork for us for the 100th episode. Sophie, one of our long-term listeners, patron. She looks after the Discord for us as well. Is a real big help. Has made a lovely piece of artwork for us, Matthias. And it's just got a bunch of kind of good moments from the last 100 episodes. Says congratulations, 100 episodes on it. I thought it would be nice for us to kind of go through it. And remember some of the cool stuff we've gone through.
Yeah. I mean, we have sort of the thing we always say, it's complicated.
At the top.
Yeah.
Then it's me and you.
Yes.
We are in the middle.
Yes. With horns on our helmets.
Mm-hmm. And then we've got the legendary Crotum in the top left hand corner.
Yeah.
With two
balls, and says it's a weapon.
Absolutely. So that definitely, if you haven't listened to that, please go back and listen to the episode with is it Dragoskald? Drags, you're gonna pronounce it better than me, Matthias, but Dragoskald.
Yeah, Dragoskald. Like yeah.
Dragoskald. Go back and listen to that. That's one of the funniest episodes we've made. It was absolutely hilarious. Then we have your ranting of people need to stop drawing sexy Valkyries.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
to tattoo or not to tattoo is a big one, because we spoke about tattoos a lot on this podcast over the last 100 episodes. And we actually have the only man or the only tattooist on here who I've ever heard say that he doesn't think maybe that the Vikings were tattooed, but also maybe one of the most important people who says he doesn't think they are.
Can I correct the statement? I mean, I don't...
Absolutely.
I don't think it was a common habit throughout Scandinavia. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was, you know, that's what I believe at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But that's it.
Yeah. No, I actually agree with you on that one. I just... Luciano, if you don't know, a month ago approximately, I gave a talk in Iceland about the possibility of tattooing in Viking Age Scandinavia. And my position on this is also that it's probably, just like what we see with the filed teeth, it's probably like certain Viking groups that are doing it, if any are doing it. And there's some substantial, if you ask me, substantial evidence for that having happened. And the linguistic evidence that we can find actually shows up in context of ritual and sort of more mystic inscriptions. Like just not so long ago, I found a name inscribed on a runestone in Norway, Flaktafaikinas. Which is actually pre-Viking Age, because it's like this is in proto-Nordic. And that means the monster colored. So somebody was called the monster colored.
What period is that?
That's earlier than the Viking Age. I think it's from the, I can't remember exactly. I didn't note the age of the stone. It's from Vetteland in Norway, but judging from the word, the way that it's spelled, it is in between, it is that period from the 500s to the 700s where the Nordic languages are developing into Old Nordic, not Old Norse. Old Nordic, mm-hmm. Old Norse comes after. So that would be proto-Nordic. So it still looks very proto-Germanic with like Z at the end and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's really, really fascinating to see that somebody is literally called monster colored. And mm-hmm. You know, the gods only know what that really refers to. But I've seen other examples of individuals being called the colored one. And okay. My theory is... based off of references to Eddic poetry, where we also see a couple of examples of coloring. My theory, and also a bunch of other, you know, a whole catalog of references to people with colored skin which is not racial, but intentionally colored. There's a distinction between those two in the sources. So based off of all of that, I think this might actually be an example of somebody who had some kind of colored skin.
And can you send me the link to your lecture? Because I couldn't find it.
Yeah, I can send you my manuscript.
So you can better
read that. Yeah. And also working on an article on it. So yeah, there's a lot of things there.
Yeah. Absolutely. But,
yeah, that was just a side note on the tattooing stuff.
There we go. So other things, episodes, obviously we have Drunk Odin, which is the great episodes with Ed, where we read through Havamal, which seems like such a long time ago now.
Yeah, but it really wasn't that long ago, was it, though?
there were some really obviously
Drunk Odin with parentheses with two eyes.
That's it. And obviously we have to have It's Nordic, Not Norse after your outburst against the word Norse.
By outburst, it was a campaign. I was trying to make people understand how we need to distinguish it.
then finally we have Lothbrok means shitty pants. Now I can't remember who it was who told us that.
Yeah, me neither.
I've forgotten who it was, but he was saying how Lothbrok
might mean
shitty pants. Not was it Roderick Dale?
I think it was.
Seems like British humor.
Yeah. and of course there's also what kind of name is Aslog.
So that's Auslog from our Watchlong series, and again Kattegat means cat shit, which you kindly let us know when we started the Watchlong.
That's right, yeah. Cat asshole actually, but cat shit can do too.
Cat which is brilliant. I think it's a perfect time to wrap up. Like I say, it's 100 shows. It's a lot. We've done a lot, and I've enjoyed every one of them. I've learned a lot, and just a huge thank you to everybody who's come along with us on the journey. And hopefully you stick with us. I'm not gonna do any plugs. Fuck it. It's just let's just wrap up. It's been a fun. It's a fun journey. Hopefully we get another 100 in there.
Absolutely, we're aiming for it. Maybe even more than that. I want to thank everybody for having joined us on this journey. It's quite interesting because I saw somebody, and I can't remember where it was, but somebody also mentioned how this has been sort of like a curious documenting of, COVID, because we started right before that shit happened, and so it's been something that has come up throughout our podcast ever since, pretty much. Mm-hmm. Which I guess is some kind of weird cultural historical element.
Yeah, we started in November. Is it November 2019, I think?
Yep.
But we started out going once every other week. Or did we start out once a month? I can't remember.
It was once every week.
It was every 2 weeks.
Every 2 weeks. Yeah. So yeah,
the man himself, Shan, appears on the 100th episode as well. I think he's at the first time everybody's got to hear your voice. There he is, the man behind the scenes who puts it all together and makes it a thing.
Mm-hmm. No, we actually went to weekly. Because of COVID, because you guys were locked down and had extra time, and we decided to go weekly at that point.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Also, that's right. You, Mateus, were the one who said Ragnar shitty pants.
Was me.
Yeah, that was back in the Ragnar Lothbrok episode. It's in the first, eight. You said it was a possible translation. It was either, woolly pants or possibly that he shit his pants.
Yes, that's right. But I feel like
I think Roderick also mentioned. Yeah, I think Roderick did mention it.
It's definitely come around again. It's one of those great factoids.
Of course it has. No, Shad, I think an extra big thank you to you because you probably put more time into this podcast than me and Mateus do put together. You know, you sit in on every episode, you listen to us.
You put up with that bullshit.
Yeah, you listen to us hours every week, editing it, trying to make it sound as good as possible. So yeah, you know, the podcast wouldn't be what it is without you. So a huge thank you for that.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate that.
Fuck off now.
Okay,
turn your camera back off.
But hey,
I'm joking.
I want to throw one more tidbit in there before I go. There is, and we're going to put the 100 art in the show notes at least so everyone can look at it. But there is Shut Up Joe, which you guys forgot to mention, which is my favorite moment from all of the shows ever, which was when Ed started yelling at what in the recording was one of our patrons who was just like scrabbling around in the background and had an open mic.
But I think live, we all thought it was somebody outside Ed's caravan.
He definitely knew it was Joe. That's why he specifically says "Shut up, Joe," is because he could see whose mic was open.
Oh no, I know, but I think I didn't see that. I kept hearing the noise, and I was like, "Who the fuck is that scrambling around outside Ed's caravan?" And when he shouted like "Shut the fuck up, Joe," I was like, "Oh, poor guy, who's he shouting at?" Then Ed is a live wire.
What I wanted to throw in there is actually for the vast majority of listeners who were not in that live recording, I replaced Joe with a dog barking sound effect.
Oh, okay.
So it's just Ed yelling at a dog named Joe.
There we go.
Also, I'm sorry for all the times I make you sound like a chipmunk, Dan. Sorry. I'm going to keep doing it.
All right.
Remember to have Luciano do his plugs. I'm out.
No, yes, absolutely. Luciano, you do your plugs. Let everyone know where they can find you. And more importantly, if you're interested in this art style, book a lesson with Luciano. Book some time with him. He will teach you how to do it. I've done a couple, and it's absolutely worth the money, worth the time. It's invaluable. I don't think there's anybody that knows more than this man about Viking Age artwork. It's unreal how much we learn every time we do this, hour after hour. It's incredible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can be found on Instagram and Facebook under Children of Ash. Mm-hmm. And we still have a Patreon page, but that's might go a bit suspended because I'm working on a chapter for the next exhibition and for the National Museum, the next Viking exhibition. So it's taking a lot of research time. And yeah, I might have to suspend the Patreon for a little bit, but it will be worth it because I'm discovering a lot of very interesting stuff. So I can tell about it as well.
Yeah. No, awesome. Yeah, please go give Children Ash a follow. I mean, the stuff you post on there is just, it blows my mind all the time. And you are, you know, you're reconstructing these yourselves. You post the images that you kind of start with and then what you end up with. And it takes some great knowledge and understanding of the art just to be able to kind of reconstruct them. And I think it's such important, valuable work that you do. So these things don't ever get lost. The archive that you have must be incredible, and I want it.
I actually put it safely on a external hard drive.
Oh, make sure
it's becoming really, really precious. It's over 100 gigabyte images.
Wow. Yeah, get a hard drive to back the hard drive up.
It is. Yeah.
Make sure it's backed up beyond Billy, because yeah, that's there's some important work in there. I have no doubt that it will be incredibly important. Luciano, thank you very much. Mateus, thank you for putting up with me for 100 episodes.
Thank you for putting up with me for 100 episodes. And thanks to all our Patreons as well for putting up with us.
There you go.